Welcome to TWIP Family. You've got kids, you've got a camera. We're going to talk about getting great photos of the people in your life, the ones who are masters of the compliment. Hey, Mom, I love how you did your hair today. You look just like Chewbacca. I'm your host and Chewbacca lookalike, Jenny Stein. If you're new to TWIP Family, I'm glad you found the show. I'm a photographer and mother of four. I love photography and I love talking about it too, which is what I get to do here. I talk to photographers about their work and about their families. We talk about some technical things that help make photos better and also about the experience of photographing life with kids. My hope is that you'll be inspired by the conversations and make photos you love of the people you love. Today, I am talking with Chuck Annarino. Chuck is the father of three boys who he loves to photograph in a documentary style. I talk with Chuck about his early days in photography and how he moved through some stages in his photography of making bad photos and not knowing they were bad, realizing the photos weren't as good as he wanted them to be, but didn't know how to make them better, then making better photos, but didn't know what he was doing to make them better. And now he is in the great place of making photos he really loves and knowing why the photos are working. We talk about his favorite camera these days, a Leica monochrome. It takes only black and white photos. So for a year, he took just black and white photos of his family. And this is a topic that I love, which is what do you learn when you limit your choices? And once again, we touch on the question of what is a snapshot and are we missing out by waiting for great compositions and light every time instead of just snapping a fun picture? Enjoy the show. Chuck, the first thing I want to ask you about is photos from your childhood. What do you have?
I have amazing photos from my childhood. I have several boxes. My father was a little bit of a photographer. He was a very hard construction worker, iron worker. And he had a Minolta that I sort of remember. I remember the brown bag that he carried in a little bit of a leather bag. And he used to take a lot of photos of us growing up. So I have a lot of fairly decent photos from my youth that I really enjoy.
What kinds of things did he like to capture about your life?
I was a very active young boy who grew up in a working class neighborhood in Philadelphia. So we were always out on our front. We didn't have much of a yard, but we were always out front. And there was a lot of kids. So I was very active. I played a lot of sports, bike raced competitively as a young kid. My dad took photos of all that stuff. And so I have a lot of photos of me in action as a young child, just being a typical boy of the, you know, late 70s. And through the mid 80s and into the early 90s. So,
yeah. Do you remember him taking the pictures?
I do not. I don't remember him taking the photos at all. I remember the camera, I remember the bag, but I don't remember him with like taking the photos at all.
So he mustn't have bothered you too much.
You know what? I had never thought of that until you just asked me that question. It's the first time I've ever thought of that question. So, and looking at it, and it's a great question because, again, I've never thought of it. In looking at the photos and thinking of them, there are not a lot of posed photos of me stopped and staring, looking at a camera.
Yeah.
A lot of it's definitely in action.
Which reminds me a lot of your photography. I think that's really cool.
That's crazy. I have to like talk to my dad about that a little bit.
Yeah. So when did you pick up a camera or had you been interested since you were young? When did you get interested?
So like I said, I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia. I don't know if anyone in the audience knows the area, but Northeast Philadelphia, when I say I grew up in Philadelphia, people think, you know, Center City, you know, culture, right, museums, all the great things that Philadelphia has to offer. When I say Northeast Philadelphia, great area. I love it. But it was really void of culture. It's very blue collar, very working class, lots of row homes, not a whole lot of culture. Yeah. So art was not really part of anything that I grew up around. It wasn't part of my schooling. I went to like neighborhood Catholic schools, you know, good schooling, but not a whole lot of exposure to the arts or anything along those lines. All the way through high school, when I was in college, I was home one summer and said, hey, I think I might want to, I've always liked photography. I used to get Sports Illustrated as a kid.
Yeah.
And they used to always have these like throwback retro sections where they would have old black and white photos of great moments, like the Willie Mays catch or the Bobby Orr goal. They're just great moments in sports. And I remember cutting them out and like taping them. It was so low rent, but I would like put scotch tape over them.
No, like laminating them, like scotch tape laminating.
Literally.
Yeah.
And I would kind of put them up in my room and stuff, but they were always black and white photos. And I just kind of liked that. That's all I knew really about photography. That was it. So I was home one summer from college, and I said, hey, I'm going to take a black and white photography class at a community college. So I had a checking account, which is hysterical, because you're going to see why in a second. So I sent my check in, and I go to Philadelphia Community College on 17th and Spring Garden. And I, you know, find the room, and the professor says, you know, hey, you're not on the list here. I said, oh, okay. Well, he said, you have to go check with the bursar's office. So I go down to the bursar's office, and they said, yeah, your check bounced. So you will either have to pay cash now plus the $35 return check fee or whatever it was. And I didn't have any money. I was like, there's no way.
This class is getting more expensive by the moment.
Yeah. So that was my photo career when I was about 20 years old, and that's where it ended. And I did not touch a camera again until I was about 27 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. It was the first time I talked. Well, first of all, I never touched the camera at the college class. That was day one. And I just got through the doors.
Yeah.
And so I never touched the camera until I was about 27 years old.
And what made you pick one up then?
So we had a bit of a turn of events in our family. I had just one sister that she was not doing well. She was unfortunately a drug addict. And she had a little baby boy. So he was 5 months old and she really wasn't doing well. Dennis needed a place to stay. So at the time, my girlfriend at the time is my current wife. So we decided that, you know, hey, this is just temporary. If he just needs a place to stay, we'll take in the little guy. And we did. And that was a Friday. Things turned worse over the weekend and we were in court on Monday and were named emergency custodians. So It happened very quickly. So we became sort of parents overnight.
Yeah.
When he was 5 months old. So,
And so you guys were just, that's a big shift for a couple.
quite a little bit.
Usually there's some lead up to a baby coming into your life.
I got a call from my dad on Friday afternoon that things weren't great and he needed a hand. And we went and we were afraid that my sister was going to come back not in the right state of mind. And we were advised to by law enforcement to take the child to a safe place where she wouldn't necessarily know where it is so that we can wait until Monday morning when the courts are open. Mm. So it was an ugly situation for sure. But we definitely did what was in the best interest of the child. And like you said, it was a quick turn of events. And like I said, at first we kind of thought it was going to be, you know, hey, 2 weeks, she'll get her stuff together. And, you know, she sort of disappeared for quite some time. And we had a child, we had a 5 month old. Dennis was my motivation, to be honest, for photographs. And it's funny that you mentioned the shoebox of photographs that I have that I cherish. That's really my motivation for picking up a camera is I took custody of this child. And, you know, I just kind of felt like, hey, my childhood was documented and here's this boy. I'm the dad here. That's what my dad did. That's what dads do. We take photos of our kids growing up and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So I had a little Fuji point and shoot. I think it was 1.3 megapixels.
Oh, it's digital. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was digital. I never touched a film camera. My first camera was digital and it had like a, you know, onboard flash that I used in every shot.
Of course.
I thought the shots were kind of cool. And at the time, this was 2004, Facebook didn't exist.
Right.
So people would ask a lot of times, how's Dennis doing? So I would send in, a mass email to like friends and I would just attach some photos and, you know, people were like, oh, that's cute. Or, hey, that's kind of good. And it was just a crappy Fuji, but I just liked it. I liked taking photos. I liked the act of taking photos. So my girlfriend at the time, she decided to buy me a DSLR camera. It was the original Canon Rebel. The D300 was my first camera.
Yeah.
So she bought it for me, and I took a boatload of really bad photographs.
Like we all do, right?
Absolutely. Man, they were horrible.
But you didn't think so at the time.
Well, I did think so.
Oh, did you?
I really did. But I guess I didn't care in a way
right.
that they were bad because I enjoyed it. That was for me what it was about. Like I just enjoyed the act of taking photographs at first.
Yeah.
And then it really bothered me that my photos were really bad.
What did you notice? Can you think about what, I mean, this might be hard to remember, but what did you notice about them that didn't satisfy you?
So around that time I started to, I like gear. I like stuff. Photography's not.
Right, join the club, right?
Exactly, right. Like that's what, you know, what do we, you know, if it's bikes, I like bikes. I, you know, look at what's the best bike. I do, you know, crazy research. If it's sound systems in our house, if it's, it doesn't matter. I just like stuff. I like to, you know, check things out and review and take a look and see what's out there. So that sort of applied to photography as well. So I, you know, started learning a little bit about lenses and, you know, I had the good old 18 to 55 millimeter kit lens that everybody started with. And, I learned about prime lenses and, you know, I learned about the 50 millimeter that's
right.
only $90.
And, right.
you know, I said, oh, yeah. wow, $90. Okay. We can swing that in our tiny budget that we had. And, I bought that and started experimenting with wide apertures. Whoa, this is cool. Look, the background's blurred.
Changes everything. Yeah.
Wow. Like, you know, this is cool. So, and that's sort of how the progression happened. So for a while, that was my motivation is like, how sharp can I get his eyes and how blurry can I make the background? Right? Like,
yes.
Like that was it, right? And I was like, man, like this is pretty good. My photos are better now. Look at how sharp they are. And then you learn some processing to make his eyes look a little bit better. And that's what I did. And I thought like, okay, cool. Like we're getting there. I'm making some progress. Now, you know, I think I just talked about that for maybe 2 minutes. That took me like 2 years. Right. So,
right.
You know, and I will absolutely say that I probably bordered somewhere between obsessive and passionate. Like there's a fine line there, right? Like when you talk about being passionate or, you know, maybe a little bit obsessive about things, I think there's a really fine line.
Right.
There were definitely nights where I was up like until all hours of the morning, you know, trying to figure things out.
Well, it's a great, I was just talking, I just had an interview last week with Kelly Moore, who does Kelly Moore Bags, and she was talking about getting obsessed. And because I was asking her, how did you learn? And then she talked about how she learned. And I said, how would you learn now? And I realized that part of learning is, if you're lucky, getting obsessed, you know, because you do learn. I mean, I think of the nights I spent all night in a dark room. Like it's dark. So if you don't have I didn't know what time it was. So, and I had the time. I didn't have any kids. So, but I feel like there's something great about that.
Oh, no doubt. I'm reading a book right now, Dan Winter's Road to Seeing, and I'm about maybe 130 pages in, and it really talks about Dan Winters, who has photographed every celebrity under the sun.
Yeah. It's called The Road to Seeing?
The Road to Seeing, yeah.
It's awesome. Okay.
It's a great read, and it's a beautiful book, too. You know, he talks about exactly what you just said, like, and what we're sort of talking about now. His is a little bit more glamorous, right?
Right.
He attended the Eddie Adams workshop, and he talked about how he was rubbing elbows with, you know, so many great photographers and editors of, you know, they went on to like edit for the New Yorker and edit for Esquire, and you know, he's rubbing elbows as a young person who's really trying to find his way. The person tells him you need to live in New York. So he does. He goes and drops everything and lives in New York. And he's staying up late as an assistant in the master's dark room. And he said some of the best times of his life was sort of figuring that stuff out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that when you're in it, you appreciate it, right? Like,
right.
I totally wasn't appreciating like 4 a.m. waking up for school at 6 a.m. going, damn, that was like... that was really dumb. I need to go to bed like at a normal time, you know,
right.
Or my wife being a little bit mad that, you know, I spent a little bit too much money on this piece of equipment or, right. You know, I just upgraded the RAM of my crappy computer, you know, so there's all these little things. And so you don't recognize how important that time is in your journey until I think you're through it. Right.
So, yeah, well, it reminds me of like having little tiny kids. How well you're so if you have when you have babies in your house, yeah. It's similar. It's like it's so much is happening that you can't really understand what's going on.
Totally.
How much you're learning, how much you're growing, how much you're changing. But then when it's less busy, you look back and whoa, what went on then? And I think it's a great part of people's stories. And I think it's really important that stage that you're talking about. And I love it. Like,
oh, me too. I mean, I don't know that I have the, you know, I'm 38 turning 39. I don't know that I have the sort of wherewithal and naivete to sort of go through all that again, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess it's, you know, when you're,
no,
young,
if something
hungry,
you would, if something, right. If something came like this podcast and like learning how to do this, like took over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was not expecting that. And I was sort of surprised. So, I mean, I feel like if something came that you were like, whoa, what's going on here? This is really fun and really neat. You can get, I mean, I don't think age matters.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And you know, it's also the part of that that was kind of cool for me is that, you know, the internet was fairly, you know, it was pre-Facebook for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't have these groups. YouTube was definitely not what it was back then.
Oh, right. As far as learning.
Right. In terms of learning. So
oh,
for me,
yeah. I know. It's so great.
So much failure and so much trial and error to sort of just get to a level where like my photos weren't awful. Like,
yeah. That's, I also want to say, I think on this show and around, I mean, I know when I talk to Zalmi Berkowitz, who you're friends with, and
yep.
We make a lot of fun of wide aperture photos sometimes because it's a typical first step, right?
Yep.
But what I want to say, when you were talking about that, well, I realized I wanted to say something, is you learn a lot in that stage. I don't think it is, like people move on from it often. Not everybody. Some people make a real, I had Audrey Woolard on, I don't know if you know her work, but she does tons with super shallow aperture and it's really beautiful. But I feel like it was funny that I think that sometimes that is such a first stage thing to do to get your 50 to, and that makes your photos really different than so-and-so's with their kit lens.
Yeah, you're absolutely
but
right.
You learn, I mean, you learn how to make a sharp photo and you learn how to focus.
Because yeah, that's true.
You're really pushing yourself to learn how to make a focused photo because you're like, oh, that eye is out of focus.
Yeah.
And so I just feel like it's interesting to realize that each stage has a place, you know, and that was just something that popped into my head when you said that, because it's come up more than once for sure. Is that
no, you're totally right. And you know, I have to give a lot of credit to my wife who for being a really tough critic. And I say that like, truly, my wife is very, I don't want to say tough on my work, but, you know, I'll post something on Facebook and it'll get 200 likes and, you know, I'm like, hey, that was a good photo and I'm happy with it. And I printed it and it's big and it's framed. And she's like, it's okay. Like, but you know, when like I get past the emotion of it and all that, and you know, the reality is that she's usually right, you know, and when something is, I think truly decent. She's points it out, you know. So
yeah.
she's a really good critic, and
that's a great gift. That's really nice.
And she sort of helped me see, like, so you know, the 50mm, then the 85, and then you get your first. And my first L lens was a 135L. So I'm like,
yeah, you were really
awesome.
Going for it.
I'm gonna
blur
this background, like, you know, it's gonna be beautiful and sharp and contrasty, right?
Yeah.
So like, I guess I did that for like 2 years, and I don't remember if it was like a specific moment or, but like, I remembered like right around like, you know, 2008 or so, I'm like, man, like I have a lot of really nice head and shoulder, mm-hmm. waist up portraits, but like, I don't have stories. I have no story. Like there's zero context to mm-hmm. to these photos. None. Like they could be anywhere. We, you know, whether we're in this park or my backyard or a friend's house, or
it's all blurred out.
Context. It's all blurred out, right?
Yeah.
The background's mush. And I definitely remember the gear that did it for me, but I don't remember the moment. But I bought a Canon 5D, the first full frame. Mm-hmm. Well, not the first full frame, but the first, you know.
Yeah, I know.
That wasn't $8,000.
Right.
The first one that, you know, humans could buy. you know, I got
the classic. It's the classic now. That's
absolutely
what it's
right. That's right. The 5DC, right?
Right.
So I had that camera and I got a 35L.
Nice.
And it changed everything. Like at first my, you know, the photos were just really snapshotish, right? There were, cause right. I had so many elements in the frame. I'm like, what do you do with all this stuff in the frame? Right. Like, you know, there's a chair over there and I have to get like super close to, and now his face looks weird cause it's distorted. I can't shoot like that. Right. Like, so it really challenged me. And that's really, I think right around 2008 was when I started to really look into, you know, documentary photography and, you know, photographers who told stories with images and things along those lines. A lot of the Magnum photographers were definitely some early influences. Some greats, you know, from the past, Lee Freelander, Sam Abel, Bruce Davidson, Elliot Erwitt. I definitely started looking at some of their work and seeing how they incorporated various elements into this little rectangle that we all look through.
Yeah.
And it really fascinated me. And, you know, just about a year later, I started the family photo journalist little blog that we started co-writing with a friend of mine. So, you know, it was an interesting way to get there.
But you were looking at photojournalists that were doing like news and stuff, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Magnum photographers, you know,
right.
Covering world strife and, you know.
So you were combining that with, oh, I'm going to do the same thing, but instead of blurring everything out, I'm going to give these photos context and tell a story.
Right? Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's really no different. I feel like, you know, family photographers, and that was the other motivation for me starting that blog was to, I feel like on online forums, especially at the time, you know, if you posted a family shot, it sort of took a backseat to anything else that was like adults. You know, like it was like not considered real photography.
Oh, totally. I remember a friend doing, this was before I did a year long project, but he was doing one. And when he posted a photo of a kid, he said, this is low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was sort of like, it's easy.
it is easy to take a snapshot of your kid in the backyard. There's no doubt, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you apply principles of, you know, photojournalism and documentary photography and reportage, like you start applying that, those elements that the greats apply to your own photography. And, you know, you develop a little bit more than just a snap of low hanging fruit.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But
you're right. That's sort of the way it was looked at. And it took me some time to, you know, gain a little bit of a foothold. You know, when you're in a forum and you visit it regularly, you know, you're trying to establish yourself a little bit. And it took some time to do that. But that was one of my motivations for the family photojournalist and sort of coining this phrase, like family photojournalism, at least at Fred Miranda, you know, wasn't being used. So I attached sort of a term to something that, you know, we were trying to do photojournalism, but just with our family, the same stuff the greats do, you know, the same stuff that the Magnum photographers do, very similar to what we're trying to do. That's all.
Right.
It was an interesting way to go about doing it.
Yeah. And were you doing, what kind of photos, how did this evolve in the families is your nephew still with you?
So we had him from 5 months until he was about 8 years old full time.
Okay.
And you know, to my sister's credit, she did a lot of things to get back in better standing, to be a more fit mother. Took her some time, but she was able to do it, and we transitioned slowly for him to go back with her.
Okay.
He went back with her sort of full time right around 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
And along that time, I had three sons of my own.
Okay. Yeah. So you had your own kids in this time. So it
yes.
started with your nephew,
correct.
But then you're still doing all this that we were just talking about with your own kids.
Absolutely.
And so this transition happened with your photos of your own family. Were you taking photos for anybody else?
I was just on a small scale, in 2000, geez, let me get it right. I did a couple things on the side, maybe in like 2007. Mm-hmm. They were definitely more portrait-y, definitely not documentary, in maybe semi loose, very loose loop documentary photography, yeah. More portrait-y for sure. Uh-huh. Maybe in 2007, just a few. And then in 2008, I did take on a couple more. I started a little family photography company on the side, as I was a high school history teacher at the time. And so I did have a handful of clients, and I used to call them lifestyle sessions, which were, you know, sort right. of like pose documentary of sorts.
Well, you were differentiating yourself from like a studio.
Definitely. Yes. That right. was, you know, sort of a thing like, hey, let's go to a park and then right. you just do whatever you want to do.
Yep.
You know, so, but not documentary per se, but, you know, the parents all dress nice and
yeah, right.
no, to a I nice know. Park
totally.
And, you know,
that's what people want or they think they want.
Correct. Correct. Exactly. So, yeah. So I did that for a little bit. But I kind of got out of that. Mm-hmm. I got into weddings, was what happened mm-hmm. photographically. So that was a cool turn of events as well. Unexpected. That's sort of, I guess, maybe a theme along the way. I've never set out like to do any of it. Like I never set out to say like, hell, one day I want to be on Jenny Stein's podcast. you know,
But you're a history teacher. Well, you were a history teacher. Not. What do you do now?
I'm in administration now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're still in schools and, you know, yeah. so that's what you say. So that's been your career, right?
Always. Yep.
Yeah.
This is my 18th year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So yeah. I've
yeah.
been at it for some time.
Nice.
So yeah. But yeah, I never like set out for weddings. That sort of came about again through Fred Miranda, which again is it was a fantastic forum. But it's still good. Don't get me wrong. It was just really, it really had its heyday. You know, I started to really get my hands around a bit of a vision with most importantly, my own family photography, which
right.
was what I think was maybe most known for around those parts. And maybe even now most, who knows?
Yeah.
But it was my own family, not other clients, not weddings at that time. I hadn't even shot a wedding at that time. So. A local friend of mine, his name's Pat Fiore, who was just recently named to Rangefinder's like 30 rising stars. He's awesome. He's a great dude. He reached out to me and said, hey, I want you to shoot this wedding with me. And I was like, hey, Pat, I never shot a wedding before
weddings,
in my life.
Like,
yeah. He's like, no, like my client, they didn't hire a second shooter, but I would like someone there because it's just harder for me to get back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen your family stuff. Just do what you do for your family. It'll be great. And I did it and I loved it. I had an awesome time. It was really, really a great time. So I thought, all right, cool. That was it. Weddings were fun. You know, I think I posted some images on Fred Miranda and, you know, people enjoyed them. And, shortly after I got my phone rang, I'm doing dismissal at school. And, it was a guy that I had made contact with, Fred Miranda again. His name's Evan Baines, who were actually still pretty good friends to this day. This is back in 2010. And he said, hey, he's from Tennessee. He said, I have a wedding in Philadelphia and I need a second shooter. And I was like, well, Ev, like I shot one wedding. Like,
right.
I'm not your guy. You know, I was just really letting him know. And he's like, no, you know, I know your family stuff. I saw your post. Just, I want you to do that. Just do what you do with your family. Just do your own thing. You know, no direction. And, you know, these guys are like really strong photographers.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
Like, you know,
but they saw something in you.
They didn't. I give them a ton of credit because I don't know that I saw it.
It's such a gift to have somebody that sees that.
Yeah. And I owe them a lot of, I mean, the first five weddings that I shot were with legit stud photographers who, yeah. and I'm still friends with to this day.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for their confidence in me and grateful for the experience.
It's a great way to get into doing a wedding too, because there's so much less pressure.
Oh yeah. No doubt.
It's really
no doubt.
Nice. I think.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, the cool part for me was definitely that, like, I never set out to shoot a wedding. I didn't like, you know, let me get this portfolio together and I'll apply for these second shooter jobs. And I was doing dismissal and got a phone call.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
like,
right.
So like literally. What I always found sort of cool, and even to this day, is that I've sort of just done my own thing. Like I've just, you know, really given my version of what I want my family photographs to look like. And that has sort of led me to other really cool things.
Yeah.
And that's felt pretty good to me that's how it's sort of organically evolved.
Yeah. Do you still shoot any weddings now?
I do. I have a business partner. Her name's Katie Merkel. She's fantastic. Actually, my road to get there, I'm sorry, I don't know if this is going to bore anybody or not, but so I second shot some weddings, and then the economy took a turn for the worse. My wife's in commercial construction, and she was laid off in like 2009, mm-hmm. 2010. So I second shot right around that time. I had a handful of weddings under my belt, and I said, hey, I'll make some extra money for the family. Let's start a wedding business. So we did. I took on about 12 weddings my first year, and I loved it. It was fantastic. Had some great clients. I still have some weddings that I'm really proud of during that time. My wife went back to work, and we were pregnant with our third child, and that's a bad equation. So it became three jobs between two people with three children, and that was too hard. So I sort of backed out of weddings, and right around that time, another good friend of mine, his name was Tony Hoffer, was looking for an associate photographer. I don't know if you know Tony and his work. It's spectacular. He's one of the who's who guys. Mm-hmm. Him and his wife Amy are fantastic, and he was looking to expand and have an associate photographer for the first time. And he said, hey, do you know anyone looking to become an associate photographer? And he didn't know at the time I was looking to close up my shop. I was really looking to get away from it. And, again, I won't forget this call either. I was going to Home Depot. We were preparing for a hurricane that was coming our way. And we had a phone conversation, and by the end of the conversation, he's like, great, you'll be my associate. So I came home with, supplies to batten down the hatches for a hurricane and told my wife that I'm going to be an associate for Tony Hoffer. So that was pretty cool. We worked out some details, and I had a great 2 years with Tony as an associate.
What kind of photography were you doing then? Is that weddings? Okay. Yeah, all right.
Wedding. Yep. So had a great 2 years there. And, that brings me to like 2014, and my boys at this point were growing. I was coaching two baseball teams, had two jobs. I became an administrator. Like it just got to be too much, to be honest. So,
yeah.
As crazy as people tell me I am, they're like, you had the dream job. You were an associate for Tony Hoffer and you walked away from it. Like, are you crazy? Mm-hmm. And my sanity was really worth a lot more, me being a father and, the husband that I wanted to be and all that was definitely worth more than the money. So I sort of stepped away around that time.
Did that feel like, even though you weren't getting approval from some people, did it feel completely right to you to walk away?
Yeah, it did. As much as I enjoyed, Tony has, I think he's up to nearly 30,000 Facebook followers, and my work was getting crazy exposure, and it was great. It was great professionally for me, but it did. People couldn't see it, but listen, when at the end of the night and you're in your house,
yeah,
that's all that matters, right? Like you're, absolutely. You're in your home with your, you have to, look at your wife and your children and make a decision that's best for everybody. And, that's what we did. It wasn't just my decision. It was definitely our decision.
And those are some of the most important decisions we make in our lives.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, to say, I'm going to step away from something that looks, anyway, I just think it's great. I like hearing those stories just to realize that people have to make those decisions.
Yeah. And, I don't regret it. And Tony is such a good guy that I think if I said to him, hey Tony, I'd like to come on back as an associate, it would be a no brainer. He has said as much, but I'm in a really great spot now. I work with my friend, Katie Merkel. We shoot weddings together. She's one of the best photographers I know, hands down. And, we produce some really nice work for clients. So, nice. But we're in a spot where we only take on about 8 to 12 weddings a year. It's fantastic.
That's a nice number.
Yeah. It's really good. So, it feels good the way that I got here.
Yeah.
you know.
And what kind of stuff? So the stuff I've seen, because I've seen your stuff online of kids. So I haven't really seen your wedding stuff. But so I've just, I mean, I did look over at your website, but I just mean that when I think of your work, I think of what I've seen of kids, and I'm assuming they're your kids mostly.
Yes.
So talk about what you love doing with your family photography now.
So I really enjoy the process of making a photograph. You know, it's blinding. Like, how many options are out there? They're infinite, right?
Yeah.
You're looking through this little tiny rectangle and you're trying to make sense of all the things that are in the frame and trying to put them in different spots and do different things with them, whether they're in focus or out of focus. And, I enjoy that. I enjoy that whole process of sort of making something happen within a rectangle that won't ever happen again, and it's never happened before. And it's up to me to trip that shutter button and decide whether or not that moment is going to be captured or not. And I sort of enjoy all that. I guess maybe that's a bit, you know, philosophical mumbo jumbo, but this is the truth.
I like it. I mean, I think it is. I was just today out taking a picture of my daughter. She was just writing a letter on the porch, but I was thinking about, so it's a pretty simple situation. What you're saying about all the choices, like, so I just had one, I had a 35 on, so it's not like I'm making a lot of choices that way, but there are a lot of choices. Like, I tried different sides and I tried where her face was framed, so she's kind of still, she's 13, wasn't moving around. So
little kids.
Sometimes it was a different kind of photo. I love taking pictures when my kids are really in action like you do too. But but it was like, I tried different sides, like which side, where the light's coming from, and do I want the stuff behind her? Like, is it important that it's square? Is it, you know, like, there are a lot of choices in just a simple photo. That actually was a very simple photo. It wasn't a complicated composition in any way. So then when you get into more complicated compositions, like I think of yours, of having action and layers and different things, more than one kid doing something often. I mean, that's a lot. That's more.
Yeah,
so the decisions are interesting. Yeah,
they're in perpetual motion. And, you know, like I said, my one friend earlier, Evan Baines, you know, he's really a student of photography, and he has given me a lot of information to think about. And we talk a lot about really what photography is the inclusion and exclusion of objects, right? Sort of including or excluding certain elements in the frame. And, you know, what I really enjoy doing most these days, and the camera I've been using for the past year really helps me get there, is I enjoy finding a composition that I like for whatever it is, right? This summer is a good example. We spent a lot of time at the pool with my boys. And I enjoy finding a composition, and I like to just sort of sit at the composition and just sort of wait, knowing that something's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen,
right?
But knowing that something is going to happen. And
can you give an example, like, of a photo that you would have done that with?
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a specific photo, or it can be. But just the idea of what kind of composition you're looking for, and then what happened.
So you mentioned layers. I like layers, and I have you know, three boys, which it's a really cool number to photograph, because, you know, a lot of threes in photography, right?
Yeah.
Thirds.
I never thought about that. That is cool.
You know, triangles, three boys make a triangle. Like, triangles and compositions a lot of times are just make it more dynamic in the frame. So that's fun, just to sort of play with that. But, you know, at the pool where I go, there's the diving board has a really clean backdrop, and it's just, there's a lot of action by the diving board. I was at the pool on the 4th of July, and they had flags up, and I love the idea of having the flag in the frame, and it was on the 4th of July. So I was like, hey, this could be interesting. Like, let me layer a flag with what's going on the diving board. So I just sort of sat there and just sort of waited. And kids were doing, you know, dives and stuff like that. And my son came up and he did a dive, and I just sort of waited, and I took a couple different compositions, you know, using the flag in the foreground with the kid off the diving board. And, you know, I might've taken maybe 10 shots or so. And then he did a cannonball, and I felt like I got it. Like,
yeah.
You know, I like here, a cannonball on 4th of July flag.
Right.
I got it. I got it. There it was, right?
Yeah, so, but it's interesting that like there was a lead up to it, which I like hearing that. You know, like it. One thing that's neat about kids is they do repeat themselves a lot. Like they were on a diving board, so they're going to keep going.
Yeah, it's predictable, right?
Like, right, so, it's predictable. But then there's a patience to it, too.
Right, it's a commitment to the composition. And that's something that I try to do if I find something I like. I try to commit to the composition. Hmm. And I think that's important, right? Like I sort of have an idea on what I think looks good graphically in a frame. Like the photo that I'm talking about, the flag was sort of on a diagonal. So, you know, using a strong diagonal and some action happening in the context of it being the 4th of July, it all just sort of worked, and him doing a cannonball. Like it was like, all right, cool. That was, there we go. I got it.
Yeah.
How
do you feel like you came to understand sort of some of those visual, what appeals visually and what works for, how did you feel like you came to learn those things?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have a good answer for you. For a long time, I looked at a lot of professional documentary photographers' work. Mm-hmm. That is that much I know. Mm-hmm. So I did not spend a whole, and I don't mean this in disrespect to anybody out there shooting, but I didn't spend a lot of time, you know, looking at, you know, online photographers too much. Like the people who are greats for a reason, right? We study their work for a reason. And that always interests me. Like, so why is this good? Right. Why is this in a book? Why is this person a magnum photographer?
Right.
And I don't always understand it. Today, actually, his name's Trent Park. Uh-huh. I was looking at Trent Park's work. He's a magnum photographer, pretty recent admit to magnum photography. And some of his work is spectacular, but I'm looking at some of his images and I'm like, why is this on Magnum? Like, I wouldn't even delete the image, because I would have never taken it, because it's not that interesting. And it's on Magnum.
Yeah.
So I don't always get it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I don't always get it.
So sure.
I don't know that I have an answer on how I know what I like.
I think it's an interesting progression just to figure out how sometimes you do things unconsciously. Like people just, even though you should never go out on railroad tracks and take photos, people do that because what they actually are like, it's leading lines, you know, like that's going to lead you to your subject, but they don't know, oh, that's a leading line. So I feel like for a while you do something that appeals just because you're, you know, it just does appeal, you know?
Yeah.
And so then you understand, oh, that's why, because it's telling my viewer what to look at, the person at the end of the line, you know?
Totally.
It's right. Leading you through the composition, but you don't know that at first.
No. So one of my former students taught me this, and I had never heard it before, and it's brilliant. I started a photography program 9 years ago at my prior school. And I taught it to seniors. I taught photography to seniors for 9 years.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I left that school and I went to a new school last year, and I'm starting photography this year for seniors. I have 23 seniors in my photography one class. So I'm super pumped about that.
That's great.
So one of my former students, he went to art school, and he came back and he heard a speaker who worked for maybe Pixar or Disney or something like that. And exactly what you just talked about is I had always said similar things that you just said, and I was never able to like put terms on it. So he said that this speaker talked about four stages of creativity, of becoming creative. And the first stage is unconscious failure, right? Like you have no clue what you're doing.
Right.
Like you're just going out and you're just shooting away, right?
Right.
But it's an important stage, right?
Yeah.
Like it's so important to go out there and just screw things up and come back with horrible images, right?
Yeah.
So and you have no clue why they're bad. You don't know why they're bad. When you take a good one every once in a while, you don't even know why it's good. Like you're just out there, unconscious failure, right?
Uh-huh.
The next stage is conscious failure, right? Like you start to learn a little bit, like, oh, okay, my images are all dark because my aperture is at f/22, right? Like I need to let more light in, right? Or I need to let light in for longer,
or
I have to increase the ISO, or whatever it is, right? You know why you're failing, right? So. Mm-hmm. You sort of figure that out. Hey, I'm failing because of this reason. So the next step towards being creative that this guy said, and this is brilliant. I love this. And I honestly, like, I think this is the coolest stage. is unconscious success, right? So you're gone out, and I think this is a really cool time. It's maybe where Dan Winters was when he was in, you know, Soho and making prints in the middle of the night, where you were making prints in the middle of the night, where I was staying up to 4 a.m., right? Like you're unconscious success, and here you are, and you're creating cool work, and you're like, man, this is kind of cool, but I don't even really know how, like, it's pretty good, and you don't even know how good it is, right? Like,
and you don't exactly know how to make it happen.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And like you're just out and it's happening.
Yeah. Right. Like I'm shooting a wedding, right? Like the second wedding I ever shot is still, I think I've probably shot 100 weddings at this point. Yeah. The second wedding I ever shot is still one of my favorite weddings. Uh-huh. And I don't know how I did it. Right. Like, you know, why did that happen that way? Right.
Yeah.
And I can't go back and duplicate that. So you're in this sort of unconscious success stage. And then the last one is conscious success, right? Like, so, you know, I just explained it to you. I knew what I wanted with that picture, right? I knew that I wanted a strong diagonal with, I knew very specifically what I wanted in that frame.
Yeah.
So it was, and it happened for me, and it's one of my favorite images. So there I was, like, I consciously made the image that I wanted to make, you know, happen. I consciously did that. So yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. So I thought that was brilliant. Unconscious failure, conscious failure, unconscious success, conscious success.
Yeah.
That's not my theory. Like, I'm not plagiarized. Like, I don't.
Right. That, right. Yeah.
No, I don't know where that came from. It was told to me secondhand by a speaker. I want to say for Disney or Pixar. If I knew the guy's name, I would footnote him, but
right,
I don't.
Right. That's okay.
But it was really cool.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense to me.
It does. And one thing you mentioned your, at some point you're saying the camera that you're using is helping you.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about your camera, the camera you're using,
sure,
and what you mean?
Yeah. So it's, I use currently a Leica monochrome camera. It's a rangefinder camera.
Can you describe what that is?
Yeah. So Leica, goes back to, I believe, the 30s. It's a German camera manufacturer of the 1930s. And they, you know, we're at that time, cameras were huge, right? Like you couldn't carry them around 35 millimeter, which is sort of coming around. And, you know, most 35 millimeter cameras had mirrors in them, right? So you're looking through the viewfinder of an SLR, single lens reflex camera, and you're looking through a series of mirrors out the lens.
Right.
So what Leica developed was something called a rangefinder, where you don't look through the lens. You're actually looking through a viewfinder, and in the viewfinder, they're called frame lines. Okay. Now, depending on what lens you have on, certain frame lines will come up in the viewfinder, and whatever's inside the frame lines will be in the picture, and anything outside obviously won't be.
Okay.
So it's a perfect tool for cropping, right? Like you look through this viewfinder and it shows you where, but, and also while you're looking through a viewfinder you can see what's outside the frame line. So if we go back to, you know, inclusions and exclusions,
right?
You can see just outside the viewfinder, and with documentary photography, I find it awesome because you can see that element just coming into the frame.
Uh-huh.
And then you click, right?
So okay. I don't think I realized that. So in the viewfinder, you're seeing more than is going to be in the frame.
That's exactly
right.
That's
really cool.
It is cool. So when you're looking through your SLR, it's TTL through the lens, right?
Right.
So when you put a 35 on, you're seeing 35. When you put an 85 on, you're seeing...
Okay, so I gotcha. So if you change the lenses,
the lines change.
The
viewfinder
change.
Never.
Now, how is the focusing?
So it's manual focus.
Okay.
So let me kind of back up just
that's
a little
fine.
Bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So okay. Leica developed this rangefinder, and to be fair, I don't know if Leica was the first one to develop this idea of a rangefinder, but they were certainly the most popular.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, they were used by all kinds of like super famous people.
For sure, right? And that's part of the lore too, as like a history for me. So. They, in, I believe, 1954, they made the first M, the Leica M. Okay. So it was an M3, and it was what Henri Cartier-Bresson used, you know, famously. That was his camera, and he shot 50 millimeters on the street. But that was the camera he chose to create the decisive moment, which, again, there goes the lure again.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's what he used, and it was all film up until, I want to say maybe 2007 or so, 2008, the camera looks very similar to the 1954. So they made the M3, the M2, the M4, the M5, the M6, the M7.
And they were always expensive. They were all film. Even then, too. Film. But the film ones were substantially more expensive than a Canon.
You're right.
And even back when I was in college, I remember looking at them then. That's why I know. I'm like, even before they were. Yep.
And they're pricey. They do have a lure to them for sure. Yeah. When you feel like you sort of know why they're more expensive. They definitely have a heft to them. They're made of brass. Very, very well made. They're a smaller camera, but you put it in your hands. You say, well, everyone who puts a Leica in their hands, go, wow, it's a lot heavier than I thought it was.
Yeah.
So they started making digital cameras, but they were $9,000. I'm like, there's no way I can afford that ever. Right.
Yeah.
So, they kept making them and I stayed interested. I bought a film one back in 2008. Uh-huh. And I never really got into film. So it just didn't jive with me, but I loved the Leica. I loved the camera. So, I sold it. 2010, I bought another one cause I liked having a Leica. Uh-huh. Did not like film again, sold it. Right. So, but it kept kind of calling me. So
well, it's just funny that you didn't like film. So many people love film these days
it just didn't jive with me.
Yeah.
I'm
glad that you said that. I'm glad you like it. I tried it. Didn't like it.
I did. I wanted to like it so bad because I liked shooting the Leica.
Yeah, right. So you could afford it.
I wanted to love it. Yeah. And I bought a scanner. I went all in and it just didn't jive. And plus it just didn't fit with me with my lifestyle. Like I couldn't,
right,
you know, be up developing film and, you know, have kids run it. Like it just didn't work.
I know. That's, yeah.
So it was tough. yeah. So the prices were astronomical of the Leica Digitals, and I just could never, ever, ever afford one. But recently, some of the used ones have been coming down in prices, and that's what happened last year, last summer. I bought my first digital Leica. It's called the Leica M Monochrome, which is funny because the only company that can do it created a digital camera that only shoots in black and white.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to talk about a limiting camera,
right?
It's manual focus. It has zero features, right? Like it's all manual. The aperture ring is on the lens, the shutter dials at the top, the ISO, the ISO is done through the menu, but it's all manual. So it has zero bells and whistles at all. It's really a strip.
How's the metering?
Metering solid. It's just, I don't even know if it's spot or center way. I don't even know what it is. It's just a tiny dot in your viewfinder. That's it.
All right.
So it's just a small dot in your viewfinder that you adjust until the dot's in the center or near the center.
Right.
And that's it. So, you know, you asked, I kind of mentioned that I really enjoy shooting it and it's the truth. It's a camera that really does, this sounds so philosophical and cheesy and touchy-feely.
Go for it.
It's a camera that really does speak to me.
Yeah.
And admittedly, that does sound horrible to say, but I don't know any other way to word it. But it really does.
I'm so glad you found each other.
Yeah, me too. I love it. It's a match made in heaven. I'm loving it. But that's really funny. But what it really has taught me to do, and it's, you know, it doesn't have 5 frames per second. There's no tracking focus, you know, when your kids run around the yard.
So you have to go slow.
You do. You have to go slow.
Can you change lenses? Do you have more than one lens?
I do. I have two lenses. I have a 35 millimeter and I have a 50 millimeter.
Great.
So those are the two that I use.
Yeah.
So what it really forces you to do, when we talked a little bit earlier about finding a composition and being patient with it, that's really what I enjoy doing. And that's the way I've really come to like shooting. Like as an analogy, when we're at the mall with my kids, we talk about, hey, if we get separated, stay where you are.
Yes. Find I say this to my kids all the time.
Don't go looking for me. Right.
Like stop. Right.
Exactly. Right. Right. So instead of having two people chasing,
right.
I feel sometimes, and I was definitely this photographer, like,
yeah. Oh, this is a great analogy. Keep going.
Think of someone right at the playground, right? Think of yourself, because I don't want to talk bad on anyone else that's doing this, but because I did it.
At
the playground, I have my 5D, I have my 35 on, and I'm running around like a fool, like chasing the action.
Yeah.
Right?
And
I'm going around and I'm getting, you know, clear shots with great contrast. But they're not great photographs. They're snapshots in a way. And you know, again, I think that was an essential stage of learning and getting better. But it's certainly not a great way to create really good photographs, in my opinion. You know, now if I go to the playground, I try to find like, okay, where's the light coming from? You know, okay, what, now that the light's coming from there, what's interesting in over in that spot? Okay, are my kids going to go play over there? And I start piecing those things together, and then, and I'll go stand there and I'll wait. I'll stand there and wait. And sometimes they come over and sometimes they don't.
Right. And the great thing is with your own kids, it's...
Yeah, well, you lose nothing.
Right. And like, they're going to be there again.
So, you know, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I mean, geez, I have a lot of situations where I'm like, hey, this is going to be really awesome.
And it never sucks bad
and no one ever sees it.
Right.
That happens a lot. But yeah, so what the Leica really does, it has this beautiful viewfinder. I mean, Leica optics are world renowned. So it has this beautiful viewfinder that I look through the world with, and has these great frame lines, and I'm able to sort of just sit on a composition. And it just becomes a matter of timing at that point, right? Like it's all composed. Right. I shoot a lot of times at like F8 or F11. So most of the scene's in focus. You know, so I'm not even focusing at that point. It's pre-focused on a certain spot, and F8, F11 with a 35. I mean, geez, I think everything's in focus at that point.
Yeah. Now, so, how do you feel about not having the choice of color?
I just bought a new Leica. I'm going to have two Leicas now. I bought an M240. Comes this Friday. I shot exclusively black and white with my kids for the past year.
Wow.
And I'll be honest. I think that I'm a black and white photographer. I've never seen color well, and maybe that's a cop out. But I've always, when I shot color, even now, like with my wedding photography, I sort of, cause I shoot DSLRs when I shoot weddings, I shoot Nikon, when I shoot weddings. But even now, like with wedding images, I really fight color. Like it looks good, but it just looks better to me in black and white. And I don't know why that is. But I don't see complementary color as well. I don't. And again, maybe that's a cop out. Maybe I should challenge myself. But, you know, for my 12 year shooting, I think that I've never jived with color. It just never appealed to me.
And so during the year that you only had, like, I love less decisions all the time.
Yes.
And you know, when I used to take photos, you know, you load your camera with black and white film and you're set. So I was used to that. I think it's interesting now for me to look at a photo. It's been a long time now that I'm used digital, but just, you have a choice, you know, it's like another choice, but I do look at photos both ways, and some I feel like, oh, that's a lot stronger in color. Like the colors tell part of the, I like how colors look sometimes, but then other times it's very clear. Like the photo I just did today, that one I was talking about my daughter, like I felt like it was easy. I was like, oh, that's black and white. Well, and I'm still trying to figure out what makes it, like what really makes the difference. Like it's something I'm exploring right now in my mind. So that's why it's interesting to talk to you about what that was like to not even have the choice of colors being part of the story.
The lack of choices is definitely liberating. Like it's not even an option, right?
Right.
Like the photos come, and it's interesting because the files come out really flat. It's a flat grayish.
Okay. Yeah. So you have to,
you work with it, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of tones, a lot of subtle grays in there to work with. And, you know, going back again, my friend Evan, he sold all his digital gear, maybe 3 years ago when he bought Leica, film Leicas. And, his whole reason is that with digital, he feels like he spent too much time looking back.
Yeah.
And now with film, you're about looking forward. And the Leica definitely does that for me. The LCD is like from like 2004. It's a horrible LCD on my Leica. And in a way, that's cool because I spend so little time, and I'm not an anti-chimp guy. Like if you want to look at the back of your camera a million times, then do it. You have this great technology. Why not? I'm not like you should be able to check and see the shot. No, if you need the chimp, that's fine. but like for me, I don't chimp a lot. The range finder.
It's so bad, right? You're saying the LCD is not worth looking at.
It's horrible. You can't even really tell what's in focus anyway on it.
Right.
And it definitely just helps me look forward to the next shot. Like you can't in
documentary. Oh, so he was saying with film, like when he switched over to the film cameras, he wasn't
once you trip
looking
that shutter,
back.
There's nothing you can do.
You're
right?
Just going. Like, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Your eyes are forward, right? Like you're always onward. You're always onward. You know what, always onward.
That's cool. I hadn't really thought. Thanks for saying that. I just think I hadn't thought about that with film. And we all have the option to turn off our LCD, by the way. But
think about the processing, right? So you're still looking back when you plug your card into your computer, right?
Yeah.
And with film, for him at least, and this was, you know, really compelling reason for him was when he rewound the film, he put it in the canister, he shipped it off to the developer, and he never looked back.
John Canlis said that. When John Canlis was on, he said that about the processing is nothing now, like when he does film. So that it's done. Once they're taken, they're done. So that is a strength of film. That's interesting.
Sure.
So
I'm sorry. With Leica, you know, the idea for me is sort of just the mentality of moving forward, less choices, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and working within the limitations. You know, I think sometimes we go out and we buy, I need a 24-70, I need a 35, I need a 135, I need a 70-200. My wedding kit is very light. I have a 28, a 35, an 85. Like if I can't get it done with that, and I have two bodies and I work within those limitations. With my personal camera, I have a 35 and a 50. That's it. And those are that I work within those limitations. The lack of choices, I think is, empowering in a lot of ways.
I agree. I think that, you can get kind of fooled into thinking that your photography is going to be better if you have some fancy thing. And at some point, there are things that make a difference, but at the same time, the essential part of your photography is not going to change. Like, even if I rented I have a 5D Mark II that I use now, and
it's a great camera.
It's a great camera. And my brother gave it to me. So it's really
he's a good
great.
Brother there, right?
So,
you got a good brother.
I do. So, but I rented a 5D Mark III and a 24-70L that I shot an event with. Mm-hmm. And I saw the pictures and I was like, yep, they're better. Yeah. Like they were sharp. The color was great. I was like, yeah, they were better, but they were essentially, they weren't wildly different than my like what I normally do. And I'm not getting paid a ton of money. So it doesn't make any sense for me to spend all that money, but it was, I mean, I can see the difference and it doesn't pain me to go back to my other camera. I'm just sort of like, I know there's, and so it's, I think that balance is interesting for any photographer because there is sort of that appeal and it's not just photography. It's whatever you get into. There's always that appeal that something is going to make your work better.
It's
just something we all have to take a look at. And then I do think that what you're saying, and this has been something that I've talked to a lot of different photographers about, that idea of the power of limitations is really, it's a real thing. I mean, to really, and you can always limit yourself in different ways, you know, deciding what kind of photos you're going to take and I just think it's a great way to grow.
Yeah, no doubt.
So one thing you talked about that I want to, we're both in a Facebook group together, and you mentioned just when we were talking, you talked about snapshots just now, but you also talked about snapshots. You had a post about, like, as photographers who are trying to make great photographs with great light and great composition, all this stuff, even your story about the park, right? So you're at the park and you're not taking just the quick snapshots. And your question was about, are we missing some snapshot, like, what are we missing by not just quickly taking pictures of things? So I just want you to talk more about that.
Yeah. So you started off by asking me, you know, about my family photographs growing up, right? Like, I don't think my dad probably has probably five good photographs of me, and I probably have thousands of snapshots of me growing up. Right.
Right.
And I love them all. Like, and I don't give any weight to the good photographs versus the thousands of snapshots. I'm glad to have the collective, you know?
Yep.
So, you know, here we are, you know, on a mission to create better imagery. And we go along this path. I'm 12 years and counting, and, you know, still feel like I'm learning a ton regularly. And, you know, I'll go to the park and, you know, I talked about running around, taking tons of shots. I'll go to the park now and I might take 30 images and I might trash them all or keep one, you know? And, you know, whereas before I would run around and take, you know, fill a memory card and keep 40 and be so proud of those 40, you know, I guess if we go back to like the stages, you know, unconscious success or conscious failure, like somewhere along those lines, the beginning stages, like, you know, we're running around and we're taking all these shots and we're, you know, hey, these are cool. And there's something kind of cool about that in a way. You know, so.
Well, and there's a book I wish I had it from the library. I think it's called Then Is Now. Now Is Then. Oh, dear. I forget the title. But it was all snapshots. You know, there's a lot of like boxes of people's photos that get just found in storage and whatever. And this whole book, and it was a whole art show that was made of just snapshots. Like, and when I mean, people aren't looking, they're very, they're interesting for a bunch of different reasons than the day that, like, to me now, because they're all like early part of the 1900s. And so one thing that's interesting to think about, or what I think about, is that we don't know always what we're taking a picture of, how it's going to be looked at by the people we're taking it for, like particularly that. And then see, one thing I think is that there's something that you're doing where you're taking a picture that you want, like with the flag picture, you want that to communicate to anybody.
Yes.
But then there's a different kind of photo that's just for your family, really. And it doesn't, and some of the ridiculous details that are part of it, who cares? I have an example where I have a picture that my mom took. It was a slide I scanned a while ago that was my three of my great grandparents were all sitting on the porch together with my grandmother and my brother and I. Now, it's just amazing that all those people were in one spot. And I think one of us has our eyes closed. It's not very like, it's just a, do you know what I mean? Like, it is what I would think, like, that's a snapshot. It's not meaningful for its lighting or its composition, but it's meaningful.
Right. If you posted that to a Facebook group, you know, they'd be like, what? You know, two likes, one pity, like, cool shot, right? Pity and like somebody harsh being like,
what?
Shot's terrible. Right. Why are the eyes closed? Right,
right. Right.
But for you, and so one thing that we try to do with our wedding photography is we try to take images that are going to get better with age, right? Yeah. Like, they're not going to get the 500 likes on Facebook and, you know, shared and go to HuffPost and all that, right?
Right.
They're just not. They're going to be classy photos that in 35 years, they're going to be like, whoa, now that's an awesome photo.
Now, what do you look for? That way do you think, well, we want this to get better with age. How do you, tell me more about that.
I think you sort of just let the subjects speak for themselves, right? Like, you don't try to get in the way too much. You don't try to put too much of a thumbprint on it, right?
Right.
Like, there's all kinds of tricks, like, to make an image, like, more than what the moment was. And, you know, in the age of sharing and Facebook likes, it's great in the moment, but, like, come on, like, that, you know, you threw a smoke bomb in the woods, like,
right. Okay. Yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Like, you're putting your thumbprints all over it. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not about the couple anymore. It's more about the photographer's vision, and that's cool. No disrespect intended to anybody whose brand that is. But I think with the good documentary photography, the photographer doesn't get in the way too much, right?
Yeah,
so they just sort of, you know, let it happen and use, you know, keen sense of timing and, you know, compositions and, you know,
right. But do you pretty- like for your family, do you like when the light is bad and there's no way to make a good composition, do you take a picture anyway, if there's something happening that you are like, oh, I like that.
Kind of, not as much anymore. A funny example, going back to like the snapshot thing that we were just kind of talking about, a funny example, like, you know, a family member would be like, oh, you know, you should totally take a photo of that. And I'm like, it's in direct light. You know, the car's in the background. Like, I'm not taking a photo of it.
Yeah.
You know?
And,
you know, because I know that it's not going to look nice. Like, but the snapshot artist, you should probably take that photo, right? Like,
well, that's the question, I guess. And can you kind of or can you kind of relax and take a picture that's less, less thoughtful? I don't know. It's just, it's a question I'm like just holding. I don't really have answers to it. And so, I think it's just, how do we, well, an example that I've talked about, before unconsciously that was happening to me is I would not take photos, when I was doing a project, like I'm doing a daily project now, but I don't make this mistake anymore. But I used to, like, if there was something about the photo that I wasn't going to share online for whatever reason, like for now I have older girls that don't always like their photos taken, or one that I, all different reasons. Usually it involves my kids not wearing clothes because they're not always wearing clothes, and right, I'm not going to share that online. Yeah. But I would sort of not, the first time I did the project 6 years ago, I wouldn't even take the picture. Because I was like, oh, I can't use that in my project. And that's stupid.
Right.
Because it's hilarious, right? That they go around without any clothes on. And it goes away really fast. Like, you think that your kids, I mean, it just happened overnight with my daughter where she's like, someone's going to see me. I can't. And I was like, wait, who are you? You always like running around naked. So it goes away really fast. And I'm glad I didn't not take pictures. Because I'm not going to share them, but they're for our family. It doesn't matter. So that's just an example. I feel like that example is also what people can do sometimes. Like if it's not a photo that they feel like they can share. And I don't even just mean people who consider themselves photographers and are trying to sell their photography. I just mean because we share images so much, or we have an image of ourselves that we want to in our own work.
I think that's a great point. Totally, Jenny. I think that's a fantastic point. And you know, as you were talking, I think one thing I thought about that sort of helps me take a snapshot. So when I'm, you know, wielding my Leica about with, you know, top dollar lenses on it,
right,
in my nice bag, I'm less prone to take a snapshot.
Right.
But I will for sure take my iPhone out and take a boatload of snapshots. and you know what? They're cool though. You know,
yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah.
I think the iPhone has really helped me take snapshots that I normally wouldn't. You know, and don't get me wrong, there's sometimes when I have my iPhone where I will try to actually take a good photo.
Yeah.
But I'm much more likely to take a snapshot with the iPhone. And I do. I think I posted an image that's in that group that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. I left my Leica in the car. I just wanted to kind of go on the beach, and my youngest son was getting over his fear of the ocean and get a boogie board. And he was just going, you know, out and coming back in on the boogie board a ton of times. And,
yeah,
you know, it was just really cool. Like, I didn't stand back and try to get someone in the foreground or try to silhouette it. Or
it's still a beautiful picture. I have to say, like, I do think it's funny sometimes when photographers are like, it's just a snapshot. But it's really better than a lot of other people's photos.
Well, I appreciate that, right? But I guess we have standards, right? But I know, I just explained the flag shot, right? Like this process, right?
Right. Well,
there was no process. I knew where good light was. I stood in, the only thought I gave to that was light and when to push the shutter, right? Right.
You're going to get the action, right? Yeah, with, like right? the height like, of the action.
Much past that. Like it was on the surface what it was. My son in the surf. On a boogie board, right?
Like, you're just turning down the volume a little bit.
I'm sorry?
You're turning down the volume on your work. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't mean volume on our shine. I mean, like, so it just kind of, in a way, the thought of taking a snapshot when you're someone who's really into photography is not really, you can't really go back to that, like, unconsciousness that you started.
Right, right, that's right.
You can't go back there. So you kind of just go, I'm just going to not worry about all the things I usually worry about.
That's right, yeah.
But and you're still going to bring something.
Yeah, totally. I don't think a snapshot means bad photo, right?
Like, right.
You know, I can't ever take a bad photo again. You know what I mean? Like, that's never going to happen.
No,
ever.
Never.
You know, I you know, the light was in the evening, the light was set, you know, low. So it had a nice warm glow to it. I knew it was going to be a nice photograph, but there was not much thought into it.
Right.
In fact, I consciously thought this is just a snapshot and that's okay. Right.
Well,
like
here's something I realized that I did. Well, this was in my, I noticed cause I write about my photos when I post them to the group that we're all doing photos, every day. And I noticed that there's sometimes that I want to say, it's just a snapshot. What I mean is, I know there's something wrong with this photo. I like it anyway. You know?
Right.
I noticed that when I started thinking about it. Like, that was my, it was sort of me saying, I know.
Yes, and that shot is Latin for, this is flawed, I know it, but I like it anyway.
Right. For me, that's what it is. Yeah. But I think the point, though, that you were also making in that post is that what are we missing if we're always...
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I guess the reality of photography, and, you know, we talk to our brides sometimes about things like this, is we're human and we're giving our perspective of the day, right? Like, that's why we're being hired, and you're hiring us for a vision. And we're not videographers. We're not photographing every moment of every day. And it's the same thing with our photography. The reality behind it is that we as humans bring everything in our life to the table when we take that choose to press that shutter or not. Right.
Yeah.
So, everything that has got us to this point in life comes with us at that time. So, you know, I don't know exactly where I'm going with all that, but I think that, you know, that's a big part of it. Right. And we decide when we're going to take a shot and when we're not, and we can't take a photo of everything. So
no,
you know,
and we don't, we already have so many photos, more than,
and we miss more than we take photos of, right? We're missing way more.
Right.
Than, you know, we might take a photo of 1% of, you know, our children's lives. Right.
Right?
So
right.
Not even, right?
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. It's really all. I like all that stuff. I just think it's interesting to think about what we're, like, kind of where photography's fitting into our family life. So,
oh, for sure. Yeah.
You know, and, it sounds like when you're with your kids, it's really enjoyable to be working on your, and I find the same thing, like if I'm at a situation, kids do repetitive things. And so if we're at the pool again, it's not thrilling, it's fun, but it's not.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out sometimes bringing my camera and deciding what to do gives me sort of a way to, you know, kind of use my brain while I'm there and be kind of creative. So in a situation that's sort of normal.
Yeah, for sure. And I will say that definitely one thing that I absolutely love about the Leica is that I bring it everywhere regardless.
Nice.
Right? Like,
yeah.
I enjoy carrying it. It's something that I like having on me. It's definitely like a tactile tool.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that. I there's definitely photos that I have that I would know for a fact I wouldn't have if I was shooting a different camera.
Because you carry it.
Because I carry it.
Yeah.
It's with me. It's with me almost, you know, like I go to school every day and it's in my bag every day. It gets, you know, it's carried every single day.
Yeah. Which is great. I carry my DSLR everywhere. So, which people are surprised, because I'll post a photo of my kids in the grocery store and they're like, they're surprised. So I'm like, well, I don't know. I just carry it.
Yeah.
So I feel like, but it is nice to have those ones too. And so it is, there is something about just carrying your camera, whatever it is, all the time that you're going to get.
Also too, and I think what's important, maybe for someone out there who's just sort of getting into family photography and along those lines, one thing people always ask me is like, man, don't your kids get tired of having the camera around? Now, my oldest is 11, and they don't bat an eye because it's their norm, right?
Yeah. Like, you're bored, like, them with it. That's what I always think. They're totally yes, camera.
Like, if my camera's not on me, it's on a shelf in the living room or on the counter in the kitchen, right? Like, it's just a part of, you know, who I am. And it's a total norm for them that they don't even bat an eye at it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, really good documentary photographers, they go on assignments for 8 weeks, right? And they don't take a photo for the first week, right?
Yeah.
Like, they have that camera out and they get their subjects acclimated to it. And by week eight, it's just part of, you know, David Allen Harvey talks about that at length, and, just part of what they do.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing to just kind of get them conditioned and, you know, train them. This is the norm, you know, dad's going to have his camera out. Mom's going to have her camera out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Chuck, this is so much fun.
I agree.
We're going to wrap up,
okay.
And just tell people, where they can see more of your work. What's a good place to go online to find your work?
Cool. Thank you. So my personal work, which, you know, is definitely my favorite, it can be seen at, www.growingupanarino.tumblr.com.
Can you spell Anarino?
Yeah, it's A-N-E-R-I-N-O. So that's my personal work. I update that fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. My business page with my business partner, Katie Merkel, who is fantastic. You can see both of our work. All work on the portfolio is about 50-50. So some work, all of hers is the good work. Mine's the work that you just like, it's okay. Hers is the great stuff.
Yeah.
I'll put in another plug too. Okay. For those of you who are familiar with Fearless Photographers, Katie Merkel is speaking at the Foundation Conference in South Carolina in November.
Oh, okay.
So she has a great story. So if you want to hear about Katie, she's a pretty inspirational girl, and I love working with her. She's awesome, and she's a great person.
And where is that she's speaking?
At the Fearless Conference.
Okay.
If you're into wedding photography, you might have heard of Fearless Photographers.
Okay.
But she is one of the speakers that are there.
Oh, great.
I also believe Kirsten Lewis is speaking at that one as well.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
So Katie will be there. I'm going to try to drive down to South Carolina to see her speak. But our work can be seen at www.merkelphotography.com. That's Merkle. And then if you're on Instagram, you can follow me at, it's just at Anarino C. So my last name and my first initial.
Great.
And that's about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking time to do this. I really, I feel like I, like with so many of the people that I'm on,
I know, we're an hour 30.
I'm like, we could just talk and talk. It's fun. So, you know, a lot to say. I had more questions, but it was great. And, so thanks for, being on, and, I know people are going to enjoy it.
My pleasure, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
As always, I hope you can use what you hear on TWIP Family in your own photography. I loved what Chuck said about slowing down and committing to a composition and being patient. You have an advantage as a parent or a grandparent or someone who is around children and are really familiar with them, and is that you can be patient. You get time with them, and you get to you know the child that you're photographing so well, and you know that kind of the places they like and the things they like to do and your favorite expressions. And you can be patient. You can wait for them. And if it doesn't happen one day, you wake up the next morning and they're still there doing the same silly things, but don't wait too long. That's what I was thinking when I said this. I'm like, I think about how you think a kid's going to do something forever and then they stop like really fast. So anyway, you can be patient. Don't wait too long. If you have a family photography question, a guest or a topic suggestion, or you just want to say hello, go over to thisweekinphoto.com, click on the Contact Us button, and send me a message. Along with a fantastic group of TWIP family listeners, I'm making and posting a photo every day this year. It's a 365 project. We share our photos and our comments on Flickr. I would love for you to join us. Welcome to Daniel and Mateo and Tim. They all joined us recently in the Flickr group, and I'm so glad. You also can join us, and you can find the group on Flickr. It's called TWIP Family 365 Project 2016. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can find the show notes at thisweekinphoto.com/family. There you can see some of Chuck's fabulous work and links to, you know, his website and all that kind of stuff. That's it for this week. Join me next Tuesday for more TWIP Family.
So yesterday, I went to Kennywood, and I think the first ride I went on was the kangaroo, but maybe it was the paratroopers. And at the end, I got to go on, and I found Cal.
Who's Cal?
Cal?
I know who Cal is, but the people who are listening don't know.
Cal is my cousin. My mom's brother's son is my cousin, and
so you found Cal?
Yeah, so I found Cal, and the first time I saw him, he was in line for the racer. I didn't get to go on the racer while I was at Kennywood, but at the end, I did get to get a big thing of Dippin' Dots. Like a really big thing of Dippin' Dots.
What are Dippin' Dots?
There are little dots of dip.
They're ice cream.
Oh, they're little dots of ice cream. They just call them Dippin' Dots. And after that, we went on a couple rides. And then my dad took a video of the Pittsburgh plunging. And then we went and bought potato patch fries. And we ate those. I think we went on a ride after that. And then we came home and Mom had the house all nicely cleaned up.